Welcome to New Books in Food. I'm your moderator, and my name is Valerie St. Brossy. Today I'm speaking with Demet Guzet. She is the author of the book Food on Foot, A History of Eating on Trails and in the Wild. It was published this year, 2017, by Rowan and Littlefield. Demet Guzet is a food instructor, a lecturer on food and culture at USAC in Verona, in Italy. She additionally writes extensively on food and food culture. She is a member of the Association of Food Journalists, International Association of Culinary Professionals, and the Guild of Food Writers. She has a PhD in food science from the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and she is also a trekker. She has been on Mont Blanc and Mount Ararat in Turkey. Demet Guzet, welcome to New Books in Food.
Hi, Valerie. Thank you for having me.
We're very happy to be talking about food that we don't normally eat ourselves. This will expand our understanding of staying alive in extreme situations. Can you tell me how the idea for this book came to you?
The idea for this book came around 3 years ago. Well, 2.5 years ago, I was in a hiking trip and a high altitude trekking trip, rather, in Ladakh in the northern India, with a group of seven other people, more than 20 horses, a kitchen, a mobile kitchen, two cooks and their helpers. We were at an altitude there where no vegetation exists, really dry land. Also, water was difficult to find. And in these conditions, for about 3 weeks, the mobile kitchen and the cooks cooked for us. Delicious breakfast with omelets and oatmeal. They cooked nice lunches that we could pack and eat along the way. We would walk the whole day, and the food was taken care of. And in the evening, we'd close it with a nice dinner and conviviality in a tent. It was quite incredible. This made me think that I have to do something. I have to tell people how explorers or trekkers in modern times, but also always, have been eating, how special experience is. Because these meals are created out of nothing, even when you have the luxury of having the horses with you or a kitchen crew, which I have to admit was a luxury situation compared to a lot of the examples I give in the book. So the idea started there. Maybe I thought I would write an article. I would submit it to a journal. And slowly grew bigger from there, because I was back in Holland. I was living in Holland at the time, and I saw a call for writers from Ken Albala, and he's a professor of history, food history specifically, at the University of the Pacific in California. And he was looking for authors to write several books, and him being the editor. And one of the books that caught my attention, it was called Food on Foot. And I immediately contacted him. I told him about my idea. We discussed and negotiated a little bit. And what I had in mind, which was a book about food in the mountains, and what he had in mind, which was a little bit broader, became what the book is today. So I covered different landscapes. I researched on different timelines. So I made it a little bit broader, and I think this made it also more interesting for the general audience.
I couldn't agree more. Being able to think about food in the mountains and then read again about food in the desert, what a contrast there is. I wonder if you would talk a little about something that actually originated, I believe, from the Native American diet, pemmican, and its very important role for explorers and climbers.
It's true. It's something that came along my path. Every time I was doing research, no matter in what geography or landscape, It's quite interesting. It sounds very simple, but of course, not something we can find and eat today unless we are recreating the history. And there are some survival groups in the U.S. especially that are interested in such recipes because they do trainings in the wilderness, etc. So I have never eaten it myself. I haven't been. But it is something that the Canadian fur traders first saw Indian Americans eating or preparing. And it is what it is dried meat mixed with fat, a lot of grease, and in some cases berries or salt or sugar, whatever they had basically at hand. Because Indians lived like nomads, they would hunt, they would have meat, but not always. So they had to find a way to preserve the meat. Often it was dried or smoked and later made into a powder and mixed with fat. So this way they could really keep it for a long time. And what I saw is that this then became the food of explorers. It was really one of the staples they had, along with army biscuits and maybe sugar and salt. It was so essential because it gave a lot of calories, it gave a lot of fat, it gave protein, and of course it didn't go bad. There were all the problems with it though, because people hated the taste of it, and this is why I thought of producing it myself once. It is apparently a little bit disgusting. It's not like bacon or beef jerky that we can imagine. It's quite delicious. It's I think also because it's repeated so much that they would eat it day in and day out, whether it's in the mountains or in a polar exploration, that I think people got really tired of it. So they tried to make different recipes of it. There have been some scientific studies where they would supplement it with different oatmeals or types of berries, or they would change the amount of other things they put inside this pemmican mix to make it more delicious. There was almost a competition, an ambition to create a pemmican recipe that was the ultimate recipe that everyone would like. But in the end, it was very unsuccessful. And I have to mention that it was also eaten in the army. So you can see that there is an interest in this type of food to have it appetizing or at least enough to be eaten and not thrown away. But anyway, so I think it lost the game of taste, or it lost the interest of people because we don't find it today. It's not in nobody's shopping baskets when we're going in the wild or wilderness.
What's so interesting about it is it was used across terrain, and it was used for a very long period of time, wasn't it?
That's true. And it's because, of course, its stability. And it did not require any special packaging. In the Native Americans, Indians, it was put in a pouch of animal skin. But later on, you could keep it in any kind of container. And it wasn't dependent on any high technology to preserve it or to keep it with you. I think that made it a very strong, iconic ingredient, food.
It was the food that no one liked eating. Is that so?
Exactly. Exactly. It's so much that in the successful Everest climb in 1953, the expedition doctor, Griffith Pugh, asked everyone in the team, to the British explorers, mountaineers, what do they want to eat in the high mountain? Because he knows appetite is a big problem. He knows that people above a certain altitude do not want to eat anything. They don't have appetite. They cannot digest. They have, anyway, nausea. And he asked them what they want to eat and what they don't want to eat. And out of the things that they don't want, definitely was pemmican. They didn't want to have any pemmican and army biscuits, which were often infected with worms. So you can see that they're iconic, but for the bad reason.
Well, it even wouldn't go to Everest. Can you tell us what the 1953 diet of Hillary and Norgate Tenzing was? The two men who summited Mount Everest in 1953.
Yeah, it's an amazing trip. You also see their picture on the cover of my book. I was very happy to be able to use that picture. and showed them having a tea after they have already climbed the mountain. So tea was certainly in the list of things they took with them. As I said before, their expedition doctor, which was one of the team members, did this survey and found what people wanted to take with them. He said he wanted to create something called the luxury box. So what they would do, unlike other explorations or mountaineering expeditions of the time, was he created a menu, a ration for the lower camps, where people would eat normal dishes like rice and potatoes, which was available there. And at higher altitudes, they would eat a mixture of army rations, lighter army rations, and things that they wanted to eat, like what was in this luxury box. And all the mountaineers gave a list of things they really would want to have and not want to have. Like I said, the pemmican was definitely in the blacklist. And in the luxury box, they had things they would have an appetite for when they arrived at high altitudes. So there were things like Kendall Mint Bar, which is a very British product, quite recognizable by mountaineers also today. And they had some candies or canned fruits, sardines, things that are appetizing because either they're very savory or very sweet. And even though they look a little bit inefficient or illogical to our thinking now, when we think about efficiency, think about weight, they are very important because they, I believe, contributed to the success of this climb. They made them at least happy, feel better. Feel appetite, so they could actually digest these foods.
When one is preparing an expedition, whether it's a mountaineering expedition, whether it's an Antarctic expedition, a desert expedition, who is the person who actually plans the food? It's not the scientist necessarily, is it?
Well, it depends which timeline we're looking at and where, because nowadays, depending on the expedition's importance, of course, if it's a big team that is going to the mountains, there might be a person dedicated to the planning of food. But if it's a trip among friends, even if they do it at a professional level, it might be that the expedition leader decides. Especially if this is the person who is financially responsible for the expedition, they might decide on the logistics and food would be part of it. Again, then it depends if they are on a summit attempt to a high mountain, if they're on a trekking event. So it depends on a lot of things. But especially if we talk about harsh conditions and ambitious plans, like in the mountains or polar trips, then, of course, there is someone that plans the meals, at least one person. But I also looked at pilgrims or other motifs for walking and eating. And there, of course, sometimes there is no plan because pilgrims didn't plan their food, but they just kind of went there with the idea of abstaining from food and got along with what they were given. By the villagers, or depending on where they were, maybe a religious institution.
Is there any such thing as extreme nutrition as a subject? If a person planning an expedition wants to be informed about what should be purchased, what should be included, how do you learn that?
I think the best way you learn it is by experience. And of course, nowadays people have a lot of material, a lot of resources in terms of books and videos and other people with experience. So I think people don't have to start from zero knowledge. But I think the best way, at least for me, that works is that you go on an expedition or even if it's a small hike and then you make a mistake or you do something, you make a decision and you see later that could have been better. And that's such a big learning that has a super high personal value. And this could be something like, for example, it's better to carry things that are lighter for obvious reasons, especially if you don't have a porter or horses or donkeys, but even if you have them. Weight is an issue. This is learned, but it's also very intuitively easy to understand why. So their packaging becomes an important factor. So anything that is in plastic bags or pouches, whether it comes like that from the producer or you prepare it yourself and put it in a packaging in a different way, in rationed way, that's a big factor. Then the diversity of the food is very important. And this you learn when you go on a trip and you think you're going to survive with energy bars and freeze-dried meals for a few weeks. And then you realize that you don't want to eat anything anymore. And you lose weight and you come back and next time you don't want to do that again. Because this lack of diversity in taste is very, very challenging, even for hikers, not necessarily for mountaineers or more challenging trips. So, of course, the higher you go in the mountain or the longer the trip, the more important it becomes to plan the food of the trip better. For example, for high mountaineers, it becomes a matter of life or death to have the right food and enough food, but also to have the right appetite. For example, about 14,000 feet, you don't have an appetite. That means not all foods are suitable. In a polar expedition, maybe fatty foods are good because you need high energy, something that keeps you warm and gives you a high caloric value. But in the mountains, this would be difficult to digest. So instead, high salty and sugary foods are better. Sugar because it helps you adjust to the altitude, and salt because it's appetizing. And also, of course, water is a big element. In high altitudes, you have to drink a lot of water to help the body acclimatize to the reduced oxygen conditions.
Water is a very heavy supply. How can people carry enough water when they're summiting K2 or Everest or such a long trek mountains?
It is true. It's the heaviest thing because when we look at canned foods or even cured meats, we always think, okay, this has a lot of water in it. So for the same reason, you don't carry fresh fruits to the mountains. So water itself is obviously the heaviest, the least efficient thing to have. But of course, some of it needs to be carried for the duration of the day's walk or climb. And usually in the evenings, you melt ice, snow, if there are water sources like rivers after filtration and purification, those waters are used because it's impossible for a long journey to supply its own water the whole time. And in the book, I talk about also the desert runners. And imagine that there is this is a landscape with no water, and they cannot carry water for the days that they're running. So in that case, the organization supplies them water every day, about 2 liters. That's the minimum that they have to carry with them. So this way they replenish the water need.
When I was reading about the high altitude climbers, and I thought, well, there's snow, they'll melt snow. But there was one description you had. It was so cold that the water couldn't melt, and they had a certain provision with them, and I can't remember at the moment what it was, so they couldn't defrost it because everything was frozen, and for some reason they could not light their fire. So they were surrounded by potential of hydration, but they could not access it. It seems so ironic.
Exactly. Sometimes the resources might be there, but accessing it is the challenge. And this happens in nature in different ways. But water is a good example. So, for example, in a high altitude, it's difficult to melt water even when you have a stove and the means to do so because water boils at a higher temperature. So you actually wait longer for heat to arrive to the same level that lower altitude. So meals cook slower and everything becomes a burden. And for this reason, the drinking becomes less also at high altitude, even if the means are there, because it becomes a hassle to actually have the enough few liters of water that one needs. And your example might be the one where I talk about Reinhold Messner and his brother being stuck in Parbat.
Yeah.
And they have no food with them, but tablets of vitamins, like these effervescent tablets. It's not meant to substitute food, but that's what they had with them. After they finished their biscuits or crackers, they didn't plan to be stuck in the mountain, which is what happened. And they tried to melt ice from around the rocks where they were sleeping, staying the night. But it was very difficult to melt this vitamin pill because it required more water, clearly. And they tried to melt it with their saliva, but it wouldn't work. So it was such a tragic scene that it sticks to your minds. And Reinhold Messner in that case says, if only we had a cup of soup. And that stayed with me because it is a tragedy that is expressed in a very simple way, because a cup of soup is such a simple food that we wouldn't even think is a matter of survival to have it or not.
One of the things that struck me over and over in the book was all the stories of the different explorers, famous ones, Odmundson, Scott, or the climbers of Everest, the numerous climbers like Messner, like Hillary and Tenzing. What was going wrong in the course of their climb, in the course of their trek to the poles, also the North Pole? This book tells you everything that you forgot to think about because you weren't planning for this kind of a disaster or this kind of a turn of events. And I think this is one of the most instructive things in the whole book, is how precarious it is to venture somewhere extreme. Could you talk a little about that?
It's fascinating because every journey on foot starts with a sense of adventure, with a sense of exploration. The moment we leave the door behind us, it could go wrong at any moment. Of course, some trips are more prone to that than others because maybe the journey lasts for years. If it's the first trip to the South Pole, it starts with a ship journey, and then there is the journey on the Huskies. And in a mountain, it's the same. There are different stages and different challenges. So planning is one element. They couldn't always foresee the last stages of the trip. In hindsight, when now we look at an event, one of those that I describe in the book, sometimes they look so silly and so easy to prevent. And you wonder, were they not aware of it? Didn't they plan well? But sometimes we have to imagine ourselves in their shoes, that they have either not the means, for example, the knowledge of vitamin C in polar explorations was not there. People had scurvy, which is the disease of not having enough vitamin C, and they would even die from it. But vitamin C was not invented. So you cannot blame them for not planning well, because there was no vitamin pills until 1930s. And all these trips in early 20th century, they had to find the cause, and if couldn't, then they have to be lucky to come back soon enough to survive the trip. And imagine these trips are 2 or 3 years long. So it's very difficult to expect them to plan for such a long trip in the best way, because they run out of food, they run out of gear, their animals die, they end up eating the animals, maybe, or each other. So history is full of disasters because of lack of food or things that go wrong.
And it's interesting that you bring up vitamin C, because this was one of the great scourges during the ocean explorations of the 14th and 15th centuries. And then it continued on as the British sailed and continued exploration, that all the crews lacked vitamin C, and someone discovered that they needed limes, they needed citrus, and British sailors got the nickname Limeys because they were eating limes. And I'm sure at that point it was not, we need more vitamin C. That was, as you say, didn't come till the 1930s. But this physical lack and its serious health consequences was a problem even then. So it was a 200, 300-year-old problem to solve, wasn't it?
It was interesting because they were looking at it different than, of course, how we look at it today. So they saw a link between canned food, for example, and the scurvy that was the issue. And they thought, is there something in the canned food that is causing this disease? So I'm talking about, again, the early 1900s. And it's funny because now we know that there's nothing in the canned food. It's the lack of what should be in there that is the problem. Because, of course, canned food, whether it's fruit or vegetable, doesn't have the same amount of vitamin C as fresh fruits or vegetables or meat would have. So it's the kind of lack of understanding, the gap in science, and this empirical but sometimes wrong knowledge that makes it very interesting to read, because today it's of course ridiculous. But when we look at the first successful trip to the South Pole by Amundsen, a Norwegian sailor and explorer, he found a very creative way to solve the problem of scurvy, and he was very proud that he said, this is probably why I was successful. And he talked about his diet and the diet of his men a lot in his journal. What he did is he took the regular rations, like we discussed before, pemmican, biscuits, there was milk powder, chocolate. He did some modifications, like he claims that his pemmican was enriched with oatmeal and sugar, and it was better in taste, and this helped its edibility. But he also took huskies with them, with him and his men. He had five men with him and 3 tons of supply, and this is for after they left their ship for the foot journey. And they carried 52 huskies with them, and with the knowledge that they would eat some of the huskies along the way. They would kill the huskies, and for their fresh meat, which was, of course, full of also vitamin C, among other things, and they would feed some of their huskies to other huskies, and eventually also to the men. And this helped them survive the trip, the conditions, and his men came back in good health conditions. And I think this made a difference between Amundsen's expedition and the Scott expedition, which instead turned into a disaster and is known in history for this reason.
Let's talk a little more about Amundsen and Scott, because one trip was so well planned, as you were just describing nutritionally, and the other was a series of unfortunate disasters. I remember something about Amundsen. He laughed about Scott. They may have met before their trips, but he laughed because he said, oh, the English love their dogs. They would never eat a dog. But my men will eat the dogs, and we will have more meat, therefore.
It's very matter of fact, and it would be an interesting study to look into at the time people's opinion about eating dogs or other animals that were maybe domesticated. Well, we cannot say the huskies are domesticated, but how were people thinking about it in different countries? And in their case, why was his approach so different than others? Because he's so proudly describing in his journals the success that he achieved due to this creative solution. And I would wonder if it was practiced in other trips. because he explains that they ate dog cutlets, and he describes how they cooked it. He said they didn't have a pan or oil to cook it with, so they boiled the meat, but it was very good. So he probably describes his solution. So he takes a lot of credit for that, and also about his own pemmican, he brags about it. It's quite fascinating, and you can imagine the rivalry they have between men, but also their countries. At the time, these are very big events to organize. The funding is difficult to get. It's a national pride, just like also the mountain trips to Everest. They're epic journeys, and it's amazing how now we can look back and see something so specific like eating meats of the huskies and how it helped them survive.
One of the setbacks for Scott, if I remember correctly, was that he was not able to get to his food supply, which was Scott's health and his remaining companions was so deteriorated that they could not press on to where their supplies were. And isn't that the case?
That's true, and that's really tragic. And this, what happened is they were just 11 miles from their supplies.
Yeah.
But they couldn't walk more than a mile or two a day. And they were exhausted. They were out of food, out of energy. They had starvation. They had scurvy. Yeah. And it was extremely cold. So it is definitely a definition of a tragedy because if they could have just gone a little bit further, they would have been at least safe. And it seems like this is a matter of life or death in such an environment.
The story of these two expeditions continues to intrigue readers of adventure because it is so fraught with the character of the Antarctic being the determining feature of how you will survive or how you won't. Now, I would like to take us to somewhere warmer and ask you to talk a little about your fascinating chapter on the first women climbers. That was in the Alps, wasn't it?
Yes, it was in the Alps, and mostly by Victorian women, but there were also French women climber. And it was the late 19th century, and women were, of course, at that time wearing big hats and large dresses, and they took that to the mountains. It was the extension of being in the outdoors, in big picnics, and this Victorian romantic idea of enjoying the scenery with abundance of food. From there, it evolved into, of course, mountaineering for men and later for women. But how women were introduced is very fascinating because their clothing was impractical, and it was not accepted always for them to be in the mountains. Well, in the beginning, of course, also the doctors advised them differently. It was believed that, or they were trying to make women believe, that if they went and did strenuous exercise like mountaineering or such things, their reproductive organs would be affected. Their motherhood, their wifehood would be affected, and they would not be suitable anymore. So there were all this scare and unscientific, unproven claims that tried to keep women at home. But of course, they were not as limited as we imagine or sometimes we are portrayed, because they were interested in arts, in nature, in documenting and understanding their environment. So when women did go to the mountains, especially around the time when the medical community was not so well respected, it was not as scientific, and people were doubting the advice of doctors, they brought a fresh view, because they would keep journals and they would have a different approach in the mountains than men. They sure had ambitions and wanted to be the first in some mountains and race with each other in a different way, but they also talked less about themselves and captured more the experience. And that was quite refreshing for me to see. And what is very interesting is the kind of food they took. And this was common for men or women at the time. The first climbs in Everest, but also later on, until the 30s or so in the Alps, sorry, and in Everest, they had so much food with them for not really necessarily a long time. They had many porters, of course, and guides who helped them. Guides were a little bit like porters at the time, and not necessarily respected for their knowledge of the environment, but more like servants helping the mostly aristocrat people going into the mountains. And they would carry legs of mutton. They would carry tons of flour and bread and casks of wine, pounds of chocolate and sugar. It was a big feast, and nobody talks about how much of it would be eaten or carried back, I wonder. But it was like an extended party, a feast, a picnic. And some of it might be also the romanticism of the period. Maybe these are recorded in an exaggerated way. But the first mountain climber in Mont Blanc, for example, she took with her a pigeon, as well as many other things like toiletry items, lots of food, and gloves and other scarves and things that were not necessarily just meant for the cold. And this pigeon was to be released from the top when she arrived. In the end, she didn't make it there. And this was a French mountaineer. And they released then the pigeon. So you see that even when there is an ambition, it is romanticized somehow. And that makes it very, very interesting.
Yes, indeed. So it was a carrier pigeon they took with them to deliver the message.
Exactly. So the pigeon, they made a really little note and attached to the pigeon, but apparently the pigeon never made it back.
Oh, what kind of descriptions did you find in the journals of these first women in the mountains? You said that they had a different way of taking in the experience. Can you give me an example or two? Is anything stay in your mind about that?
I don't think I could quote one right now on top of my head, but they were more poetic and like a diary of a person rather than a report of a military man. Mm-hmm. And this is quite interesting. What they were describing, the scenery, the flowers, it was like a field note, a diary of the trip in a very personal and intimate way.
Mm-hmm.
And more reflective, more perceptive than saying, okay, we were here at 7 o'clock, at 8 by 8 we reached this corner, and from there we took a left turn. And this is very, very striking.
Yes, the military style is rather sterile, isn't it? And the diary style might be poetic, but it's also somewhat botanical if they're noting what kind of flora is along the way. It's interesting, that contrast. I would like to ask you about a fascinating food supplies that were taken on Everest by the Japanese female climber. When I read what they were carrying, I was so impressed and curious. Do you remember who I mean? The Japanese climber?
Exactly. It's the first Japanese, well, I should say it's the first female climber who made it to Everest. And that's Junko Miyazaki. And what I have to say first, this is an interesting fact, is that this was the 1970s, and she was getting ready, got a permit to go on the mountain. But she was also recently married. And imagine at the time, especially the Japanese culture, she felt, or she was maybe forced to feel that she had to first complete her duties in her family. So she became pregnant, she gave birth, and when her child was 2.5 years old, she started this trip. So all this time, for about 3 years, she planned the trip, but she wasn't going. And it is quite fascinating how the priorities were determined, but still the ambition was there, and she, in her own set of cultural limitations or conditions, she became the first woman to climb Mount Everest. And of course, her food list is just as interesting and culturally different than other climbers, because we see a lot of Japanese food, like gyozas, these dumplings, miso soup, or sake, or seaweed, or rice cake, and green tea. It's quite refreshing, out of all the pemmicans and the biscuits and things that we recognize and always hear that are not delicious. So I have a feeling like she had quite nice, delicious meals up in the mountains.
And what's so interesting about the diet that she brought is that it's no different from everyday Japanese diet, yet it seemed also to be very suited to extreme travel.
That's a very interesting point. You're so right on this. And I think it could be that because in the West, we think that we need to control nature, that we need to create food that is like a tool that needs to be specifically engineered for certain environments and certain limitations like weight and concentrated calories, etc. And it seems like she didn't have food like that, or she chose suitable Japanese equivalents, but we don't see anything like pemmican in our food basket. And maybe some things are naturally suitable because, for example, let's take miso soup. Is already salty, it's already savory, it's appetizing and easier to eat in high altitude. And or if we look at sake, I don't know what to say, because it seems like still in the 70s, alcohol was maybe for relaxing effects part of the diet of climbers.
Yes.
But
it was pickled vegetable, which is part of every Japanese meal, seaweed, the miso. These are everyday foods. In a restaurant, you order them. At home, you have them. It struck me as I could have eaten all the food she ate with pleasure.
And I've seen some of this in other climbing cultures as well. And that's why there is no one climbing cuisine or mountain cuisine or expedition cuisine, because everybody brings to the mountains their own background. And of course, from the West, we might have different backgrounds, but our objectives or our attitude towards the event might be so dominating that maybe we focus on deficiency, calories, rations, and then we might end up all having a standard similar diet like pemmican and biscuits. But when we look at Russian climbers, for example, they take caviar in the mountains. Or we look at French or Swiss climbers and they took or take still saucisson or cheese, mountain cheese with them. So there are things that comfort people and are more suitable for these environments that naturally become become the food of the expedition.
It's a fascinating subject, and I think you have opened doors for readers to learn more. I would like to now ask you about the pilgrimage and diet. And I would like you to talk a little bit about Santiago de Compostela, which is the most famous pilgrimage of Europe, which began in 1100, I believe, to journey from Northern Europe to Galicia in northwestern Spain, to the Cathedral of Santiago. And people did that on foot for centuries and still do, some on foot still. So that's a big food plan, isn't it? Could you talk about
that? It is a big journey, and it is very significant because there is commitment, there is sacrifice, there is a lot of symbolism, and it's not a journey to arrive to an external point, but it's a journey like any other pilgrimage, more to arrive to yourself through a symbolic path, through a predetermined religious set of customs. And that's why I think it's still important today, and people, of course, do it in very different ways than in the Middle Ages. But, for example, in the Middle Ages, I found that lords were traveling with their escorts, but then ordinary people would go with groups of people, or they would be meeting other people along the way. So there were also even class differences among these people who walked the trail. And, of course, food was an important element because people had to stay in lodges or pilgrims' huts where they could get some food. And they started sharing this information among each other with guidebooks or notes that what was good where. It was like a gastronomic tourism in a way. Of course, not with those intentions, but it becomes part of the journey to sustain itself. Go ahead, please.
How did the pilgrim plan to carry food, or did they plan to eat along the way in the pilgrim inns?
They did plan to eat along the way because the ideal for pilgrimage is also not to own anything along the way, not to make it burdensome, because the burden is more spiritual. It is about abstaining from food rather than seeking it. So that's the practical element rather than the focus of the journey. And in any case, these are not physical challenges as climbing Everest or going to the South Pole, but they're rather being able to restrain oneself from the luxuries of the daily life, being on in nature, but not pushing oneself to achieve a certain speed or distance in one day, etc. So they would carry, and sometimes today still you can see and buy these, but more as a souvenir along the path. They had these shelves they would use for water, drinking water. They had a pouch for essentials like their pilgrimage passports, which they would get stamped at inns. There's a whole set of rules, which is interesting because in other environments we don't necessarily see it this way because it's not dictated by an external organization other than the hiking group or a mountaineering group or an expedition group. So in this case, there are a lot of symbolic approaches to everything as well.
And because this is a very long tradition in Europe from 1100, it's understood that you are doing something a certain way for a certain purpose. What is the time, if you remember, that's required to cross the north of Spain? Because people would be coming from France, Italy, and other parts of Europe. But if you're on foot and you cross into Spain from Perpignan or the Mediterranean side of Spain, is that a three-week journey to Santiago? You remember?
I do not remember. And it really depended on where they started. Because yeah. Now today we can arrive with a flight to anywhere and make the trip much shorter, but they have to really leave from home and walk the whole way.
Yeah, of course. I know that there are people who cycle this, but people always do some of it by foot because that is the point. And as you say, the purpose is to remove yourself from your customary life. And climbing a mountain does the same thing. I think that sometimes a pilgrimage across a long stretch of terrain is harder because you have to discipline yourself not to go somewhere and buy something and not to be distracted and not to give up because your feet hurt. So the nature of pilgrimage imposes extremes, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's all self-imposed because, as you're saying, the nature, the geography is not pushing you to your limits, but you have to refrain from going out of these limits that are created for the path, for the trip. And, for example, another pilgrimage trail, not in the one in Spain, but in Italy, Via Francigena, that ends in Rome, it was from England and goes through France and Switzerland and arrives in Rome. It goes through Tuscany. There are so many foods that was offered along the way. Some even, some recipes of the Middle Ages remained active, used, and not forgotten because of this this pilgrimage. And some travelers described it like as if they did the trip for the food because there was so much enjoyment. Then you, of course, wonder how much of it is a sacrifice to be on such a pilgrimage.
That's a very interesting aspect to that pilgrimage, because there's the pilgrimage that is based on self-control and discipline, and there's the pilgrimage that can be enjoyable.
Exactly. Also, Inca Trail, for example, it is a pilgrimage of some sort, or at least it was. It is said to be on a pilgrimage trail in Peru, but people today do it as a hiking experience. So it is very touristic, and it could be more or less difficult depending on the path one chooses or the length of time they do it in, and the high altitude makes it difficult to go. It's a little bit like a hiking trip rather than flatland long-distance pilgrimage, but it has changed its meaning, obviously, because we are not Incas and we are very external to the location, so the intention is not no longer spiritual as it was meant to be.
And being outdoors has become very common as an activity in the late 20th century and the 21st century, so the approach is not it's not as unusual.
Go ahead, sorry.
No, please.
You made me think of how these trips became very individualized because, of course, technology also helped that we have light material, we have better shoes, we have good backpacks. We have also communication technology. We have food packaging that preserves better and is lighter. So it became a personal challenge rather than an epic challenge or a national challenge or a spiritual challenge. Whether we are talking about being in a mountain or in a desert or any environment, even for pilgrimage, things are a little bit more easy, of course, these days. So the definition of these trips changed with our intentions and with our means.
It seems that there is much more to write about when it comes to food and people as they are traveling in different ways. I'm wondering if you will be continuing to write more or perhaps another book.
That's a good idea. I would love to explore more, in fact, but maybe I need more time to find the right angle, because this book was a great journey for me to go into different landscapes, different time periods. And What I came out of it is the learning that it all depends on our intentions. So it's a representation of our intention, what we eat and what we don't. And why we take something is just as important as what we take. So perhaps that angle of what it signifies, the food that gives us comfort, that is that could be a book topic.
It would be a very interesting book. I want to thank you so much for this fascinating talk about your book. And we have learned an enormous amount. I have become more curious, and I'm sure other listeners as well. So I want to thank you once again. We have been speaking with Demet Guzet, who is the author of Food on Foot, A History of Eating on Trails and in the Wild. This was published by Rowan and Littlefield in 2017. Demet Guzet, thank you so much for speaking with us. We have benefited enormously from this interesting, interesting tale.
Thank you, Valerie. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for listening, and thank you again from New Books in Food.